All right, welcome everybody. Can you hear me okay? I have a hideous cold, and so if I erupt into phlegmatic coughing, please excuse me, and I'll just hand the baton over to Helen, who is probably a better interviewer than I am.
No, but I also have a terrible cold too.
Yeah, we're both in bad shape. There may be two corpses up on this dais by the end of the whole thing, but hey, it was worth it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, and welcome to what could be the geekiest panel at South by Southwest. How many of you out there are sci-fi fiction fans? Okay. Right. Okay, and how many of you are designers, and by designers I mean engineers as well? Okay, so you're here to find out about the future of your livelihood. All right. Okay, that's what I thought. This is all about you. All about you. Brief introductions. My name is Johanna Blakely. I'm based at the Norman Lear Center. It's a research institute at the University of Southern California, and we study entertainment and media, conceived quite broadly. On my right, I have the venerable David Murkowski from Frog Design. Yeah, you like that? Venerable? Yeah. I thought that matched well with the notion of a frog, right? You need to sort of up the ante a bit. Helen Walters from BusinessWeek.com. Businessweek is venerable enough, right?
That's true.
And then Alonzo Canada from Jump Associates. So two designers and a journalist with a design background. And, you know, I'm going to kick it off with the question that is the title of this panel. And then we will end up going in all sorts of different directions from there. But first, I thought I'd ask Alonzo to sort of weigh in on the question, will tomorrow's world still need designers?
So I would first answer that with absolutely yes. A lot of the work that we do at, not to do a plug, but a lot of the work that we do at Jump is design strategy and helping companies basically empathize for their customers, right? And so I think that design does a fantastic job, more so than any, you know, superpowered computer, at creating empathy for people. Because at the end of the day, design answers and solves problems in a way that, you know, ideally will move people on an emotional level. And it's that emotional level that I think is missing from Ray Kurzweil's argument when he talks about, you know, the singularity is near and that undeniably, you know, computational power is exponentially increasing. However, it's very much on a logical basis, right? I mean, that computational power is good at kind of doing MIPS, you know, processing information at, you know, incredibly super fast rates, but it's very computationally oriented and very logical. And I think that the one thing that design is fantastic at is at the analogical approach to problem solving, where you're actually kind of persuading and you're creating experiences and you're tapping into people's emotions from a place of empathy where, you know, we have this thing called the limbic system that causes us to feel. And it, you know, there's a neurological response to that. And I think until computers are able to get to some sort of physical substrate level where you actually, they can actually feel like humans can, it's going to be a long time before they can actually replace the act of design.
So your sense is that no matter the computational power, these computers are never going to function like brains, like human brains.
I think they can function as brains in terms of their ability to compute.
Right.
However, their ability to actually feel, you know, like in the brain, like, you know, when we experience thought, it's both, there is a sort of, there's a logical state to it. There's a sort of conscious state to it where you're actually kind of processing A plus B equals C, for example. But there's also like this physical state where you have neurochemicals that are released in the brain, things like dopamine. Like, you know, often when you're learning or you achieve something or like when you win a race, you know, the brain will secrete dopamine. You get that feeling of elation, and which drives those emotions. And so thought and emotion are inextricably linked or married. And I think until computers can begin to kind of tap into that emotive level, which is very much a physiological experience, that it's not going to happen.
Well, I wonder, it sort of begs the question, you know, how far can simulations really go? To what extent can we fake something that seems so human and so physically based? I just saw an article in The Economist, I think it's the current issue, and it's about Jeff Hawkins, the Palm guy. And apparently he's leveraging his fortune that he's made from Palm in order to do all this neuroscientific research in order to create computers that operate in the same way that brains do. Mm-hmm. He's got some geeky, you know, terminology for it, hierarchical temporary memory or something. But it's so funny because he's working with all of these hardcore computer programmers and neuroscientists, and they're like, you've got it all wrong. This is not the route. You know, you can never make a computer seem like a brain. And he's like, it's precisely because people don't think that I can.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to turn to David. I know he has some really interesting ideas about the singularity and about the future of design, a different take from Alonzo. So if you could sort of give us a little bit about your impression of what's coming up.
Yeah, sure. And actually, to play on your original point that this is actually all about you, I actually would like to turn it all into a question for you. How many of you actually think the world needs designers? Raise your hand in the future. All right. Awesome.
Oh.
Why? Right. And it would be heretical for me to sit up here and say this, all right, we don't need designers because that's my job. So I share the same sentiment as you, but I think what I'm challenged by is the sort of authoritarian position that designers have been put in pretty much since the sort of World War II post-industrial state of design, that, you know, one person represents a kind of an authority because their intuition has been selected for, like today on the stage here. If we really kind of went around the room and asked every one of you why, we'd have a plurality of opinion, and that's great. And I think if you listen to the talk that Henry Jenkins made with Stephen Johnson, a lot of these same ideas came up, right? That there's sort of power in participatory design and participatory thinking. And my view on the singularity is to move it away from the techno-singularity that Kurzweil and others talk about, that, you know, I think Alonzo definitely underscores, right, as somewhat of a fallacy, and instead to suggest that it's kind of here already in a way that our sort of global mind that we're able to create as a result of connecting with each other. Zuckerberg talked about a little bit of this just now. That's really the power of the idea of participatory design, is that we can all commonly come together to create something bigger, sort of a gestalt than one single designer is capable of. It brings into question, though, some pretty important issues like, you know, how? How do you actually get multiple people to build one thing? And that is a challenge, and we do see some examples of that. I know Helen has some pretty interesting perspectives on that. And I think if we kind of look at some models out there, like Wikipedia and Craigslist, right, these sort of peer production economies that are actually creating the content in a participatory way, we can start to understand how the actual tools themselves will change to be designed by all of us here in this room collectively, as opposed to sort of that sort of individual authority of design.
Yeah, Helen, if you could say a few things about how businesses are responding to these trends. And I know you were talking a little earlier about open design systems, and even companies like Procter & Gamble have embraced this notion of innovation. I find it fascinating.
Sure. And I think one thing, just to step back for a second, is to look at the definition of design when you're talking about this. And to David's point, design has evolved itself within the 20th century and in the beginning of the 21st century. And I think it's so interesting now that we have these tools, and now that designers have these tools available to them, to remember that this has been going on for a while. So when punk music came out of a very specific time within England, and the music and the design and the art and everything was democratized then, and that led to a whole surge of innovation and surge of creativity that then influenced other people. And I think that it didn't put designers out of jobs. Photoshop, excuse me, when Photoshop came along, and, you know, all the doom-mongers were kind of saying, oh my God, everyone can be a designer. It's great. Everyone can use these tools. It doesn't mean that they're a designer, but they can use them. And I think that having that increased design literacy within the world is a really important and a really helpful thing for designers as a whole. You know, if everybody in the world sees how hard it is to make a great piece of design, then that's going to make your job easier as designers. So the open innovation strategy that many companies have adopted, so P&G has been doing this for a while with its connect and develop strategy, has, I think there are two other examples that I'd like to mention that are doing something interesting. And it's also important to remember that we're just at the beginning of this. Other people have said this in other talks that have been going on at South by Southwest. But this is really early stages, and there's a lot of experimentation going on. And Mark Zuckerberg was talking about the, you know, beacon advertising system that they were putting into Facebook, which was really, it didn't go that well. But, you know, they will iterate, and that is part of the design process. But so Muji, how many people know Muji? Okay, so Muji is a Japanese brand that it stands for no brand, and it's a housewares shop essentially, and they have they commission a lot of designers to make products for them, but their essence is pure design, and they have a lot of the designs are made by a guy called Naoto Fukasawa, who just creates kind of perfection in design form, and Muji realized that their clientele is pretty much designers. It's people who really appreciate good minimalist design, and it's pretty affordable too. And they realized that they could tap into their customer base, which was, you know, these creative people who appreciated these design forms. And they teamed up with a guy called Kohei Nishiyama.
Yeah, Nishiyama.
I've completely forgotten his name. Sorry, Kohei. To set up a system that works over the internet whereby people can upload their ideas of designs that Muji should make. And then there's a voting system. So people put up their idea of what they want to see made. And then if a product gets more than 1,000 votes, Muji will put it into production. I think this is phenomenally powerful as a design tool. And it doesn't preclude the need for designers. It just allows other people access to manufacturing. And I think that's hugely powerful. Shut up now.
One claim that can certainly be made is that the number of designers in the world has completely exploded. Alonzo and I were talking about this. There are so many more amateur designers out there now because you guys, professional designers, have made it possible for them to do all kinds of things they were never capable of doing before. And it made me think of something that we think about a lot at the Norman Lear Center about celebrity culture and the way in which we have so many different outlets in order to project and broadcast ourselves now, so many more than we ever had before, that the crisis is really not getting on a stage. It's having anybody in front of the stage paying any attention to you. Because everybody's become a celebrity. Everybody is out there to be heard. And it makes you wonder, if everybody is a designer, then where are the consumers of that design? Are we working toward a system where everybody will be designing basically for an audience of one, themselves? They'll be making some design tool that's perfectly made for their own lives, and that's it. Is that a problem? Is that something that you ever see coming down the pike, Alonzo?
I think it's interesting. I think we are entering into this wonderful age of moving from consumer culture to back to producer culture, or a culture of creation where tools are now in the hands of people, giving them access to create mashups and new designs. I mean, like Threadless is a perfect example of this type of phenomena. And at the same time, I think that as people participate, they also learn more about their own talents and their own preferences. And I think some people get in and realize that maybe they're better at being an accountant than they are doing desktop publishing. And I think a good example of this is that, you know, Nike for a while now has been experimenting with personalization and customization. I'm sure many of you have been to Nike ID. And I personally know people who have designed their own shoes on Nike ID, and they don't wear them anymore because they're just freaking ugly. You know, and I think they kind of get into that, and it was either a bad experiment, and maybe it's something that they enjoyed, and it might take them further, and they might try it again. Might get a little expensive after a while, or they completely opt out. And obviously, if this, you know, for Nike in terms of, like, I think creating, everyone's where they're creating products for themselves, I think is a wonderful vision. I think it's terribly difficult to actually execute on. I think you actually have to create systems where you basically prevent failure. So if people can actually go in and design their own solutions, you actually have to design those systems in such a way that people are not going to create ugly, bad, crappy designs, which is a very difficult thing to do, which I think is something that designers are particularly equipped at in terms of kind of designing those types of systems. I don't think anyone's actually figured it out yet. I think the stopgap solution that Nike has right now is if you go into Nike towns across the globe, you can go in and they have what are called design consultants. And I actually have a bag at home. It's like a little overnight bag. It was a wonderful process. You actually sit down with a design consultant, and they basically walk you through things like color combinations and pattern combinations and help you make those types of solutions. And you walk away with something that ideally is probably better than you might have originally thought of. And so on some level, I think it kind of opens up this notion of participatory design, which I think is a fantastic thing. Yeah, and to build on that, I think the way out for designers in a world where design is becoming both increasingly popularized but also commodified is to actually look at for higher level opportunities of design. So the way that I kind of restate what Alonzo was saying is that what we're in the process of doing is really, as designers, creating contours for other designers to create within. So Nike parameterized that application, right, online, the Nike ID shoe store, and to some degree, they parameterized the people that they hired in those shoe stores to design for you. And so there was sort of a meta design going on, right, where sort of you're designing the design process that your end user will actually participate inside. And I think that's kind of where design has to go, in the same way that just the history of technology and the history of production in westernized nations has kind of moved towards this sort of knowledge and information worker state. Is that we're kind of getting higher and higher in the process of what it means to design. I think it's a lot of where service design comes from, experience design, right? It moves outside of the boundaries of the object and into the intangibles, which are harder to define. And I think where we sort of see the intangibles becoming tangibles in these contours and these sort of limits and boundaries that you set for your user group or your, whatever, your community to design within.
I'm curious, what do you think, how are we going to be able to tell amateur designers from professional ones? I'm wondering if the main criteria of difference would be that professional designers are creating the design utility tools that everybody else is using, and that amateur designers are creating the final instantiations, the objects that they need in order to live their lives a little bit better and in order to have fun for leisure activities, whatever it is. Do you think that that sort of binary is going to stand? Anybody interested in answering that one?
I think that an amateur designer has just as much right to call him or herself a designer as a professional. And I think that what you've seen, again with Facebook, but you know, the designers of apps are making quite a tidy living off some of these apps that they've designed, and some of them are coming from a totally non-design background. And I think it's just as valid as anybody who's been through the system and who has learned design formally. And I think that's what's so interesting about it. I think that, you know, this makes design a richer place, and I think that it equalizes the system so that everyone can talk to each other. There shouldn't be a kind of a hierarchy system here. You know, everyone's in this together, and everyone should be working towards whatever their goal is.
The issue with that I see actually it's happening already right now, is that we have too much design. We have too many problems being solved for us that may not have even been there in the first place. And I think what that shows is that today, in the 20th century, we had a problem sorting out supply. It was limited resources. And now we have a problem sorting out demand. There's too much. And so I think with designers, that there's a certain class of designers, and maybe many of them are in this room, who will actually be designing the systems that frame all the design being output, all that content, or this idea of creating meta tools to create boundaries around that content. I mean, think about YouTube, or think about, right, where all the networks are going in terms of offering anytime, anywhere kind of content. It's just too much. And if you've ever read The Paradox of Choice, it's basically what I'm aping here, right? That idea that if you put 3 jams out on the table, it's easier to make a choice than 21 jams, because the easiest choice to make is no choice at all. And so we actually need to limit that problem of demand on the part of users and give them basically cues as to what designed objects have more value. The problem with that is we also have this tension and desire for personalization, right, and customization. And we want sort of perfect one-to-one pairing with the designed object and myself. And so finding systems or rules that allow for that kind of connection between me and the designed object, i.e. recommendation systems, to date is very poor. And this might be where kind of the whole singularity and the MIPS, right, the sort of the faster computational processing going on may help us, is that it can sort of lead to better pattern recognition. I think the Netflix recommendation contest, right, the sort of $1 million prize. I think it's interesting that the best candidate was only able to increase it by like a factor of 0.8 or whatever it was, right? I mean, over Netflix's engine. I mean, it's really marginal improvements for a system that's designed by a bunch of PhDs and mathematicians together. So I think it's a real challenge until we actually have better processing power to actually push that needle. But I think we do need to sort that problem out and create those systems that allow for that demand to be modeled better. I mean, it's interesting. This, the notion of amateur versus, I'll call it expert designer, is really an anti-postmodern sentiment, right? I mean, like in a world that is increasingly flat, those notions of, you know, expert versus amateur actually go away. So like in a long tail world where there's an infinite number of preferences that cater to, you know, millions or billions of different individual preferences, that notion of amateur versus expert, I think on some level becomes rendered useless. And so I think going back to what Dave is talking about, I mean, so then designer, I think what designers are called upon is basically to, in a world of infinite choice, you know, help create systems or filters that, which is what Netflix is all about, right? How do you actually create filters that are meaningful for people that actually, help you eliminate, the million choices down to like the 12 that you actually care about? It's an incredibly difficult problem. So I think what it does, it, again, it actually kicks the, like, it kicks designers' call up to a higher order, where instead of just kind of designing a particular thing or the one-hit wonder, you're actually thinking more systemically about how can you create better solutions that optimize people's preferences and choices.
Yeah, I think the main difference that I was trying to identify between amateur and I used the word professional was the paycheck opposed to no paycheck. So I'm wondering, in that kind of world, do you see, where do you see the revenue stream in the long tail world of design where everybody has the ability to sort of make what they need?
I mean, I think Chris Anderson's article in the latest issue of Wired talks about this whole notion of free. I think it's just like in terms of the innovation space right now, I think the most exciting thing happening right now is business model innovation. And that's because the old licensing models and subscription models are basically being turned on their head. And now suddenly it used to be that, you know, revenue models, you could put them on one page and there was like 12. And now there's 25, 35. I mean, there's, and they're growing all the time. And I think it's just like, it's a wonderful time to kind of be experimenting in terms of how can you play with free in such a way that you can kind of monetize it, create revenue streams. And I think this notion of like actually participating in communities for, I would argue, not huge amounts of money. Again, like go back to threadless.com, for example. I mean, people participate, people put designs up in threadless.com. It's not about the money. It's about, you know, the joy of kind of creating your own design. It's about reputation. It's about identity. It's about status. And so social currency, I think, is taking on like new contexts of meaning that go beyond just the paycheck. And so I think what it means to be a designer in terms of professional versus amateur, whether you're actually being paid for it or not, I think again, it's kind of like it's flattened, right? And so, just because you do design for a paycheck does not make you any better of a designer because you're doing design out of for reputation or for participation in a particular community.
Now, do any of you, and I think this is really an appropriate question to any of you, do you see any backlash against custom design on the horizon? Do you see people just sort of sick of having so many options, being so involved in the creation of their experience? They just want somebody else who's smart and talented and who has good taste to just do it for them. Somebody that they can worship and say, that's the design I like. That's the right style. Do you see that resurging in any way?
I think so. And I think that what sometimes those of us who are focused on the design world forget to pay attention to is that some people just really aren't. They don't care. They don't want to customize anything. They'll just buy the sneaker that's in front of them, or they'll just buy, you know, whatever it is. They're not engaged with the design world. But I mean, I think that I think both can coexist.
Yeah, I'd say obviously with the issue of choice, right, and that issue of over demand, that an inevitable anxiety forms in consumer culture, and I think actually that's what's responsible for a lot of the DIY hacking culture, right? Is in many ways kind of taking it's not really customization in the same sense, because you don't really work with sort of a palette of options. It actually breaks the contour model. In some way, it's the ultimate renegade designer, right? Someone who kind of builds and by analogy by extracting. And I think that's actually an interesting scene to watch. And it's sort of polar opposite. The other interesting scene to watch are the people who are extremely affluent and can pay for, to some degree, the sort of interior designer of your software, hardware, entertainment experience. And I think we are going to see more of these kind of, you know, Nike ID shoe consultants across all sorts of ranges of our experiences, because we can't be bothered. We're just too busy. There's sort of two categories of problems I like to think about. Designing solutions for problems, right? That's my sort of definition of design there. And the first category is first world problems, which all of us have. And that's, you know, getting your iPod synced, you know, making sure your lights go off when you go to bed and doors open when you walk through them and whatnot, because you can't be bothered to push a door. And those are really awful problems to design for, because really we're not shivering in caves anymore, right? We're not sort of scared at night. Those are the kind of problems that sort of make up the bulk of the real world's problems. And those are design problems that need to be solved. And so what I'd like to see is a move away from such a hyper focus on those first world problems, because I think it is creating this kind of anxiety of consumerism. It's sort of degenerative on its own self. And a shift generally of design from expert to pro-am down to amateur, all levels, focusing instead on that second larger category of design problems.
I'm curious if you have anything to say about the importance of failure in design. You know, creating these big systems that give people so much power. I mean, Nike ID would be a very small sort of limited example of this, but you give people just enough tools so that they can screw up, right? Well, what is the value of that? I'm sure all of you have used design tools that have been too big for what you needed. And I'm sure that led you to down certain paths that you wouldn't necessarily have ventured down before. And you got some ugly results, but it probably ended up ultimately helping you in making something very worthwhile. So I guess one of my anxieties here is that we feel like success in design is when we get it right. But to what degree is it good to get it wrong? And do you think that we're going to optimize our tools in so many different ways that it'll be harder to get things wrong in the future?
So I would disagree with that. I think that the design process is all about learning. And so really it's about kind of finding new knowledge and applying it in clever and compelling ways. And that's where the failure comes in, because through failures, you actually learn. And really, like, the prototyping process is really just it's testing hypotheses, either physically or intangibly. And you kind of put those out in the world in such a way that you get some type of feedback. And in that feedback, you learn as to how well that particular hypothesis holds true, or how well the solution that you're creating actually solves the problems that you're trying to solve for. And so I think no matter how sophisticated tools come, there may be particular domains where the percentage rate of getting it right increases. However, I would argue that in terms of just like our ability to learn and explore new knowledge is on some level infinite. And so, you know, if we will just move from one known domain of knowledge to another unknown domain of knowledge, and again, that whole process will kick back in.
I think some of the most of the companies, in fact, that I've talked to, I can't speak as a designer, clearly, but pretty much all the design companies that I've talked to say that they learn the most when they fail, and that failure is a hugely important part of any design process. I don't know how many, how many of you saw Michael Lopp's talk from Apple yesterday, but he was talking about Apple's process, which involves... one of the things that struck me was that they make 10 prototypes for every app, and they really see them through to quite a developed level, and by giving themselves the freedom to go along those paths and to essentially at the end of it ditch 9 of them, I think that allows the designers to be free. It allows them to experiment, it allows them to innovate, and it allows them to come up with the products that, you know, that designers and people love so much from Apple.
I think, that's the word, right, of this issue is prototyping. And I'm sure almost everybody in this audience is doing prototyping in one form or another. You know, at Frog, we've actually moved almost completely away from doing any reference specifications documents, right? These giant use case sort of, you know, 1.1.1.1.2 kind of, you know, if the user shall check this box, then, right? Because it's enormously complex and unwieldy, and things in a system are actually impossible to describe in a state like that. And so we have these, you know, reference prototypes, right, that we use. In the car industry, they make clay models, right, of cars, full size, full scale. They don't actually work. And it's primarily for executives to kind of come down and look and go, yeah, that looks good, build that. And we kind of create that same kind of object, this reference prototype. But then you kind of want to move it into a state where it's sort of, well, we have two sort of categories, looks like and works like. Yeah? And that first category, looks like, is very much the car model I just spoke of. But the works like is actually the really important one. And that's where Apple's design process is extraordinary. It's really a generative process, right, where you're testing for fitness. And that fitness can be tested against users in some kind of user testing scenario. It can also be done in a participatory design fashion where they're modeling it with you in real time, which has actually proven to be more successful lately. But in the end state, what you get is the sort of cone of reduction down to a form, right, an artifact that you suggest is the final product. And even that you don't fully understand because it plays inside of an ecosystem of products and services that are way beyond the domain of whatever company you're working for. And you can't predict for that, which is where we get the kind of permanent beta, right, kind of launch early. A lot of the 37 Signals talk was, you know, talking about this issue of just getting things out. So the nature of what a prototype is has shifted dramatically just in the last 10 years as a result of thinking about failure is actually a good thing. And that in some ways, prototyping is just designing failure, right? Because your number of fails that you're going to have over the number of successes is actually higher. And that's a hard thing internally for companies to understand, that we're actually going to pay you for failure because they actually, you know, give you a big paycheck. And I think we were talking about this the other night. It's like, you know, I want to see a lot of design for that. And the reality is, they don't. They see a lot of failure.
What about those successes that, I mean, David, you were talking about sometimes you're midway through the process of making a new consumer product, a new piece of plastic that does something just a little bit better than the last piece of plastic did. And you're like, does the world really need this thing? You know, and you can just imagine the piles of them in, you know, in the garbage dumps in, you know, around the world. And so the question that arises is really, is sustainable design really the issue for designers in the future? Is that the sort of ethical path that you feel that most designers are probably going to embark on as we become more and more concerned about over-design, too much design, too much demand?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a struggle because you look at something like the iPhone, and I'm sure 90% of us have it here in this audience, and I'm sure all of us have that wonderful feeling of never having to go back to an older phone, right? It was remarkable. It really did kind of transcend the category, and in doing it almost defined a new category, may or may not be phone. That's another kind of singularity, right? Sort of the category itself of phone. But the question really is, you know, how many of those, right? Again, back to first world problems, how many more iterations of the phone or any kind of category of object will we need before enough is enough? And maybe never. Maybe there will always be greater and, you know, better things to do, especially with fidelity, bandwidth, things like that becoming more available to us. We can imagine experiences that, you know, we can't have right now. Augmented reality, ubiquitous computing, like a lot of these things have been talked about for the last 30 years. So maybe that's it. We'll just keep kind of progressing towards that. But the amount of waste that generates as byproduct, both in the failure and the success, is enormous. And it is now the ethical challenge for designers to contend with what it is that they're designing. And unfortunately, it's not solely the domain of product designers, right? It touches manufacturing, it touches sales, it touches the entire design and construction process. And so product designers have a voice, and I think their voice is being heard probably pretty loud recently. There are a lot of initiatives out there right now that are talking about this issue of sustainable design. Clearly, our community is galvanized by this issue, as are many communities with what's happening out there. But I think what's missing is kind of having each discipline inside of the product development process come together and start figuring out frameworks for basically how do you analyze, how do you audit, how do you evaluate, how do you know? So you look in the architecture world and they have LEED certification, right? The product design world has nothing. Right now it has a series of kind of empty texts, right? Sort of like hurrah statements about what should be done, but no action is actually being made on a framework level to actually create that sustainable model in a product design process. So it's early, but I think we all know it's coming.
I think, I don't know if Frog signed up to the Designers Accord, but I think that is, it's one of these statements that has been released recently, which I think will hopefully have some kind of lead, similar to a system similar to LEED, whereby all of the materials that are used in a product design and the entire design process will be done according to sustainable principles. And I really do think that is the designer's role. It's you know, this has to be pushed from somewhere. And I think that the designer is in a really good place to really be pushing that. Now, that becomes even more critical, therefore. I'm so sorry. It's so disgusting.
There's no phlegm, though. It's fine.
Anyway. I think that one of the most important things, and something you see from Frog and from Jump and from IDEO and you know, consultancies like this, is where design is taken on at the C-suite level, where design is taken seriously by the people who are paying money for it, and where it's being commissioned by someone who has a directly vested interest in it. And that's what these consultancies do really well. It brings design up the agenda, and it makes it a critical part of whatever this business model that the client is in, you know, does. And I think that in order for design to keep its role and to have this this role as like the ethical prophet or ethical evangelist, it needs to have that access to the C-suite. And I think that we're seeing that change within companies. There are a number of companies that really get the power of design and that really, you know, really understand it and are really embracing it. And I think that's something that will only improve.
You know, Forbes did a really fascinating study where they quickly looked at the top 500 companies in America and the CEOs there and what their degrees were, what their education background was. And there was only one CEO in the entire list who actually had a background, graduate MBA like degree in design. Any idea who that was? Yeah, Steve Jobs. And it's frightening. Right. I mean, just
that's changing too.
It's changing, right? Exactly. And you're seeing the development of schools that are intersecting design and business. I mean, almost every school that has an interactive program has birthed out a sort of either a wing or a whole new school devoted to the intersection of business and design. That's fascinating, I think. But just like in the 70s, we saw IT basically be a sort of a huge gap at the executive level of awareness. And now almost every executive comes with a pretty sophisticated understanding of how information technology supports business. I think the same thing is happening right now, sort of the zeitgeist moment for design at an executive level. So I think it is important that we speak to those people. And right now it's a process of education, but soon it will become a process of collaboration. And yes, Frog, I think, and also Jump, right, are on Designers Accord. Val Casey, our executive creative director, mm-hmm. Started that before she went over to IDEO. Yeah. So we're actually a big proponent.
I was going to say, I mean, I think it's to design, like to take a sustainable point of view on design, it's an imperative. Like it's not, in my opinion, it's not a choice, right? I think that, you know, as designers, we need to take that up as an imperative and realize that I think, you know, the good designers or good designs, you know, both implicitly and explicitly understand that when you offer up a design or a solution to the world, you know, there are points of view that are embedded in that. And I think being conscious about that point of view from a sustainability standpoint, and really taking on, like, approaching that from many different levels, not only in terms of the way that it's made, but, you know, how does its expression of form actually, you know, communicate, notions of meaning around sustainability. I mean, it's really, you know, it's a complex process. And I think that, you know, it's up to designers, again, to take that on as an imperative and, you know, understand the points of view that they are either explicitly or implicitly embedding in their solutions and, you know, take on the charge of, you know, creating something that is more sustainable.
One more question on this front, and then we'll move on to the geeky sci-fi stuff. And then we'll have questions. We'll be open for questions for the last 15 minutes. So prepare those questions now. Maybe this is a question Helen wants to take. I'm not sure. But what sort of training do you think 21st century designers should require? How do you see the curriculum changing in order to embrace the very new methods that are evolving and the new kinds of deliverables that people are going to be expected to offer? And here I'm talking about sustainability, and I'm also talking about training designers to create systems for design.
I mean, I think David touched on this already with talking about the intersection of design and business within both design schools and business schools. And I think that's a model that we will see continue. And I think it's really important. I think design thinking is something that Business Week has been talking about for a while as a new methodology for business. And I think that it's something that needs to be taught at a school level. And you know, I think that I think students need to have the balance. It's, you know, it's that difficult mix of, you know, if you're a student, you want to be able to experiment, you want to be free, you want to be creative, you want to be out there, and you want to be crazy, but you also want to be taken seriously when you graduate and you join the real world. So I think that schools are doing a good job of this, in fact. And Business Week a few years ago, sorry not to plug Business Week, but a few years ago launched a design
venerable
schools.
Business Week.
Sorry, yes, I apologize. launched a survey of design schools and looked at those that are really taking these issues seriously. And it's been a, you know, it's a slow process, you know, for schools to evolve their curricula, but it's happening, I think.
Lanza, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I think that designers of the future are going to be more hybrid humans. They're going to be more the types of folks who can toggle back and forth between analogic versus logical thinking. The types of folks who can dip in and create a great solution, but also validate that against some type of business plan. The types of folks who can actually go out and do some type of social research and, you know, understand, come up with insights about people, about what's important to them, what do they find meaningful in their lives, and translate those into viable business solutions. I think it's that kind of thinking, that multidisciplinary type of approach, not multidisciplinary teams where you have an engineer and a designer and a market researcher. It's the kind of person who's able to kind of posit all these different skill sets and experiences in their brain. I think what we're just now starting to see an acknowledgement that, you know, design at its core is an intensely multidisciplinary act. And I think that the educational system is starting to change in that way. And the challenge is like, how do you get students in, give them a classical education and get them out within a reasonable time frame that's not going to break their parents' pocketbooks? And so like doing that in a, you know, 4 to 5 year time frame is going to be incredibly challenging, because you don't want to you need to develop some level of expertise, which is why I actually teach a class at Stanford. And we really push the students to focus on small product design projects that are, you know, where you're basically taking something that's no bigger than a bread box. And the reason for that is we want to give the students exposure to the whole design process. You know, if they're actually kind of going out and trying to design complex ecosystems or complex service solutions or even a car, it's just too big to wrap your mind around. But if you can kind of get them down at the level where they are experiencing the whole process along the way, that's where they learn the core skills. And it's really those core thinking skills, things like basic concepts like, you know, do you know how to structure a good argument? Can you write well? Can you draw well? I think on some level, like, you know, drawing is really the currency of designers. And that's where you really develop visual thinking. And it's a visual thinking, I think, you can ladder up into more sophisticated tools. But you can't take someone who is, you know, is not adept at visual thinking and then plug them into, have them use sophisticated tools in a very sophisticated way. So on some level, I mean, there is a core set of skills that I think is not going away at all. And I think that, you know, I think the better design schools are actually mindful of that.
Now, I have to ask my geeky sci-fi question now. I sent all these questions around to the panelists, and there was only one that David wrote back to me and said, oh, awesome, I want to answer that one. Get this. Okay. Will the ability to stop artificial intelligence from self-improving be the ultimate design challenge of the future? Will the existence of the human race depend upon it? David.
Confirm or deny? Deny.
So yeah, nanobots will take over and we'll all die, and the Matrix will happen, right? And we're seeing that kind of recurrent design motif in so many movies and so many works of art. It's been around ever since the days of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, right? I mean, it's just a continuation of the same sort of, you know, abject fear of mortality. So the singularity really isn't anything new in that sense. But what it does pose is a sort of an ethics of despair, right? Like, am I okay with the human quality, the human essence of being disappearing in favor of a race of autonomous silicon substrate things that are collectively intelligent? And I don't know, maybe. But the important thing is whether or not I'm willing to fight against that or not. I need to take a stand now on that. Not because the singularity is inevitable. I mean, you know, Kurzweil's out there saying, you know, 2045, it's going to happen. You can set your calendar by it. Hey, it's great. We'll actually see if he's right or not. But either way, we know that complexity is increasing, and it's doing it through forms of matter that are basically beyond biological, right? So Earth, then there was life, and now there's technology, and intelligence is kind of just riding that wave. So I think that the important question is not whether or not It will or won't happen. I think let's posit that it will happen just as an argument for understanding whether or not we're interested in defending some of the human essence, sort of the limbic, the emotional, what Alonzo talked about in the very beginning, because it may be the case that that's kind of just evolutionarily necessary for intelligence to move on. And that we're like the pager, you know, we just had to kind of come along before the actual mobile phone could be developed. And so we just sort of have to ask ourselves if that's okay.
So I have a bunch more. I have a lot more questions, let me tell you. But we'd love to hear from you guys. There's a microphone in the center. We totally will not be able to hear you unless you talk into that mic. So cue up.
My name is Christina Jackson, and I have a question. Actually a comment and then a question. The first part is the discussion started out with you guys talking about how anyone can be a designer, that anyone has the ability to be a valid to use that labeling in a valid way. But yet at the same time, we're talking about raising the ante as far as bringing designers to the strategic business process and giving them greater involvement in business process. And they just don't seem to square with me, because the thing is, I mean, I think you can come up with a distinction, but to lump everybody into the same pool, to me, seems to kind of diminish the professionalization of design. I have to admit, I'm involved with the AIGA, so in the interest of full disclosure. Mm-hmm. But so that seems to be at odds. And then the other thing is, you're talking about design schools getting on the bandwagon and embracing business. And I have to be honest, I've been a recruiter for 8 years, and I just don't see it at all. And I've worked with a lot of design schools around the country. I don't see design programs expanding anything into the area of business. The business schools are doing a fantastic job. Stanford, Kellogg, Columbia, Suffolk. I mean, those are all schools that are bringing design into the curriculum. But the message that I've always gotten is we have to focus on the fundamentals, you know, layout, color, you know, teaching them the tools. But we really don't have time to get into all the, you know, issues around business and building relationships and understanding profit and loss and, mm-hmm. you know, learning the vocabulary of business. So I would love to know if there are some design schools that, you know, are embracing it. And I'm not being critical of the design schools, because I think they have a lot to do. I'm just saying that there's a gap there, and I don't know what the answer is, but it's there.
Just real three schools I know offhand, I'll turn it over, but CCA, ITP, and CMU. Are all schools, are all design schools that have birthed out either a business sort of wing, right? So that is a collection of syllabi, or they've actually created a new school based on that.
There's also IIT, which has a joint design plus MBA program. It's a three-year program. And Art Center is also doing a tie-up with INSEAD in Paris. So we're starting to see a few programs that are either they're kind of creating curriculums or kind of semi-hybrid programs where you get a dual degree.
Right. There's a lot of programs that are happening kind of jointly with another school, I think. If you like, you could look on Business Week online and you can see our last year's list of 50 design schools.
I read Bruce Nussbaum religiously.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
No, I'd be very pleased.
Yeah. I just would love to see some initiative take fire to get design schools to get to the point where they realize, you know, they have to solve the problem. And it's not necessarily putting a fifth year. I know some advocate that, but it's not necessarily that. But I think something should be done, because I think designers come out of school with this world that's opened up with design being heralded and elevated, mm-hmm. but they don't have the ability right out of the gate to sort of tap right into that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a shame. I think that's a problem.
Can I just take the first part of your question? So I do believe that everyone can be a designer. However, I think that certain people have natural aptitudes, right? And so I think, you know, certain people have proclivities towards athletics versus music. And I think that, you can become a multidisciplinary type of person either through formal training or informal training. I think the folks who get there through informal training just have a natural aptitude for it. And that's what happens. Now, I think they're the exception, not the rule. But I do think that, I actually work with folks like that. So, I mean,
well, the problem that I see, though, is that, you know, even though it's good that people are able to create on their own and not have any kind of training, formal mm-hmm. training, I think if the world were full of people that call themselves lawyers or doctors, you know, it just diminishes, you know, mm-hmm. the design profession, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. it's
I think you see the same thing in music, though, don't you? Where a lot of people are recording music and they're musicians just as much as Susie Sue is a musician. Wow, that's really weird.
Oh.
I don't know where she came from. Wow. Okay, I'm showing my age. Shut up.
The same place that Pager came from.
But design is an act of creativity too, right? I mean,
well, let's move on to questions at the mic because I know everybody in the back can't hear this little insider conversation up here. So go ahead.
So hopefully this will be on topic. I'm curious whether you have seen any successful models or beginning of models of open source design, which along the same lines of software, people have regrouped to solve a single problem by splitting it up and each kind of bringing in their own interventions.
Yes, I have actually. There's a really new venture that just launched a week or so ago called Cluster. I don't know if any of you guys saw that. And it's exactly this kind of idea where they're kind of uniting ideas. They're getting people to suggest ideas and improvements around one idea. And they just launched at the TED conference that was held last week. And they had, I think it was 1,200 submissions of ideas for products. And then over the space of the weekend, they had, you know, a whole online community suggesting ideas of how to make this actual product. And then at the end of 72 hours, they had a game that they created for the purpose of the conference. Now that was a gimmick. That was, you know, that was what they did for the purpose of the conference. But this is also a serious business plan where people, designers can upload their ideas. They can send in their ideas and then people can invest in them or not. And I think that's a good example that I've heard of recently.
I mean, there's hundreds of examples of open source models for development being applied to actual software development itself in terms of the internal processes that get it done, distributed, remote, or outsourced. I actually think we're being failed right now by the industry. And if anyone from Adobe is here, I'd love to talk to you. Because the tool itself, the creative suite, let's say, it seems like it's kind of gone down an evolutionary dead end, especially when you compare it and contrast it to what's been going on the web. I think a lot of designers are very excited about the kind of collaborative generative possibilities that the web offers in a pretty quick iterative cycle. And Adobe, specifically like Photoshop and Illustrator, feel to me kind of like first-person shooters when the whole world has moved on to massive multiplayer online games. So why can't I just kind of assign someone a buddy list or something and start Photoshopping with them, right, in the tool? Why can't I kind of play that sort of Photoshop layers game that's been going around, right, real time? And maybe that's with another designer with me at Frog, right, or different with the client, or maybe it's just an end user, and we talk about kind of flattening that whole designer curve. And I think that's a sort of an open source content creation model for the actual artifact itself. And I'm not talking about the content like a YouTube video. I'm talking about the tools themselves that we're building with these tools. So if you don't make the tools kind of collaborative and generative, then the actual kind of software that you make is just going to be much harder to get there because you're not going to build that into the process of the design itself. So it's sort of self-reflexive. So I'd love to see, I mean, I don't know, how many of us have said like it was done with layers. I didn't need to do any more with Photoshop, right? And great, now you can make a shiny button in like one step. But why can't we do like much more kind of collaborative and playful design exercises with each other in those tools? So I would love to see the open source sort of development philosophy really sort of hit the creative tools themselves.
Oh, yes.
All right. So now the Adobe person has to come.
Yeah, the Adobe person come to the front
of the
room.
User needs latent.
A question?
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering, as we talk about all these schools that are taking up different programs for all these, design for students and teaching them, you know, how to properly, you know, learn the fundamentals of design and things like that, as more and more schools take it up, isn't it becoming sort of clear that, it's just kind of the antithesis to the question. That this very panel is named after. It's, does tomorrow need designers? Doesn't that indicate that it's clear that tomorrow does need designers? I mean, what brought on the question exactly? Does tomorrow need designers? Because, I mean, look around. I just wonder what brought on the question. Like, what's the background to that?
Well, the question was actually written by a colleague of ours who is pretty darn sure that the world won't need designers. Mostly because I think he has really great faith in crowdsourcing, and he just thinks that crowds are going to be able to accomplish so much more than professionally paid designers are. So
he's in PR, by the way.
Yeah, he's in PR, and he's probably in the room somewhere.
Sorry.
is there anybody else in the room who agrees with him that, you know, we're just being so anthropomorphic and so retrograde and so anachronistic in our thinking that we're really not taking into account what the real consequences will be of a Kurzweilian sort of singularity occurring? Is there anybody out there who thinks that designers surely will not be necessary? Oh, we have one guy. Excellent. Yep. Excellent. Oh, come to the mic.
And he can twirl fire if you didn't see him at the frog party last night, half naked.
Yeah. He does well. And then we'll get to the next gal in line. Sorry about that. Yeah.
So I think if we take the if we take the Kurzweilian idea to its limit, what happens is it's not just logical. The modeling of emotion and creative design all ends up in there. Because if you look at a digital process, you can model an analog process, but you can't do the reverse.
Exactly.
So once that's built in and once everyone's sense of design is uploaded and part of the total brain, then perhaps it will do better design than any one person. So I think that's the reason we won't need us.
And I think that's totally the problem, and why there's so many designers in here, and why the fundamental answer is no, but for one, yes. It's all yes, but for one, no, is that we can't fathom it, right? It's so removed from our brains to understand what that one organism, that singularity is. I often refer to it as it's like an ant knows nothing about opera. It can't understand what that thing is. It's culturally removed from it. And I think it's sort of a blind spot in our own mind's eye to imagine what happens when that kind of analog digital simulation actually happens. So that's why it's sci-fi and it sounds kind of funny and we get to watch it on TV. But increasingly, we are seeing the kind of mechanistic process of simulation applied to the creative act, whether it's something simple like Google Image Labeler or Mechanical Turk from Amazon or some of the weird kind of, you know, neuroscientific brain interface layers they're creating where monkeys can control joysticks, right? I mean, there's a lot going on out there that is actually worth inspecting to basically question whether or not his hypothesis at its logical extent will or will not happen. For the short term, of course, designers will be necessary. There's so far to go before something like, or unless 2045, you believe in that. But barring his sort of like minima, I think there's a real need to inspect that. And that's kind of what I meant by my joke around the pager model, right? Is like, I think we should really start asking that question. Posit it as true and think about the ethics of sort of decay and despair and what it means to lose the human essence, because that's the conversation we should be having, not whether or not it will or will not happen.
Next question.
Hi, this is sort of a question to you guys as like senior designers. I've been in the industry for maybe like around 5 years, and I've seen a lot of my seniors sort of, you know, over the years kind of get swallowed up by the business. When I first saw the title of the talk, I'm like, okay, so is this going to tell me what's going to happen to me in 20 years? Because I see these other people in 20 years and they don't really do design anymore. And I was wondering like what you guys role, like see yourselves as, like evangelists, designers, business people, like marketers or what? Like, I don't know what kind of role model I should be looking at as a designer, as a young designer myself. So how do you guys see yourselves?
Someone's looking at me. I guess I have to answer that then. It's interesting. I mean, I don't necessarily spend my days kind of heads down designing like I used to. However, I do feel like I'm actively, I mean, my role at Jump is largely we're designing a company. You know, we're designing a culture. We're designing offerings and relationships with our clients. I mean, it's really on some level like that mindset, you know, kind of like on some level they call it design thinking. But I mean, it's really just kind of being conscious about what you are actively creating on some level is fundamentally a design act. And so I just sort of see that I've kind of moved from one medium to another.
I do think there's an education happening and there are, we're in desperate search for mentors because design, if we kind of go back to that spectrum we were talking about where there's sort of the commodification of the design process, right, as sort of the mechanical, the production. And then there's the sort of the higher level we've been talking about where it's systems design and sort of boundaries and contours. Then I think what needs to happen is an education around that sort of higher level for design, that that's an angle, that that's a way you can go. It doesn't imply that you need to understand the business context. I think there's a natural proclivity to actually move away from that on the part of some a large amount of creative individuals who see that as kind of anathema to the process. And that's kind of the challenge that these design business schools are having. That said,
you are designing inside of a system. There's a reason why that word ecosystem is appearing all the time now. It's a recognition that the artifact, the object that you're making, website, product, whatever, is larger than the sum of its parts. It fits into a bigger system. And I think what we need right now are those mentors, those people who have done that work. I think people like Jonathan Ive at Apple are probably a really good example of that, right? I mean, they've kind of transcended just the hardware design and grown to understand the software and the services and everything, and, you know, experientially that surrounds the product. That's someone to look to. But they are few and far between, because it is, again, a sort of a nascent understanding around the design potential that's available out there to you and to me.
Okay, I'm afraid we've run out of time. For those of you with remaining questions, go ahead and come on up and we'll answer them here. Please join me in thanking this fabulous panel, and thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.